The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press, Religion News Service, New York Times News Service, and The New Yorker. Our first article, which was published by the Associated Press on February 2, was written by Maria Sherman and entitled, Jimmy Carter Wins Posthumous Grammy for Narrating an Audiobook of His Sunday School Lessons. Los Angeles. Former President Jimmy Carter has won a posthumous Grammy Award. Carter, the peanut farmer who won the presidency in the wake of the Watergate scandal and Vietnam War, died in December at age 100. Prior to his passing, Carter was nominated in the audiobook, narration, and storytelling recording category of the 2025 Grammys for Last Sundays in Plains, a centennial celebration. Recordings from his final Sunday school lessons delivered at Maranatha Baptist Church in Georgia. Musicians Darius Rucker, Leanne Rimes, and John Baptiste are recorded on the record. It's Carter's fourth Grammy. His posthumous Grammy joins his three previous ones for Spoken Word Album. If the former president won before his death, he would have become the oldest Grammy Award winner in history. Jason Carter, Jimmy Carter's grandson, who now chairs the Carter Center Governing Board, received the award on his behalf. Having his words captured in this way for my family and for the world is truly remarkable, he said in an acceptance speech. Thank you to the Academy. In the category, Jimmy Carter beat out Barbara Streisand, George Clinton, Dolly Parton, and producer Guy Oldfield. If Streisand had won instead of Carter, it would have been her first Grammy win in 38 years. Currently, the oldest person to win a Grammy was 97-year-old Pinetop Perkins in 2011. He's such an enormous music fan. He loves the creative aspect of music, Jason Carter said backstage about his grandfather. It's been an important part of his political life, an important part of his personal life. He's like an artist in many ways. Former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have two Grammys apiece. First Ladies Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton have also each won. Former Presidents Harry S. Truman, John F. Kennedy, and Richard Nixon were all nominated but did not win. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on January 31, written by Adele M. Banks. For D.C. Airport Chaplain, Disaster Training Becomes Reality. The Reverend Nace Lanier was at home Wednesday evening, January 29, watching a movie with his family when he received an emergency text from Washington's Ronald Reagan National Airport, where he is senior chaplain. After years of preparing for a rare and forbidding moment, the Southern Baptist minister headed to Reagan National to join the team responding to the mid-air collision of a regional passenger jet and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter, killing 67 people on the two aircraft with no survivors. We have trained and prepared for an incident through the years, said Lanier on Thursday in an email to RNS. Working with the staff and communicating with the emergency coordinators allowed us to quickly set up a location that was safe, quiet, and as comfortable as possible for the friends and family. The impromptu arrangements, said the chaplain, are aimed at giving family members dealing with unexpected personal tragedy a place to gather physically and emotionally and have some privacy as they confronted the suddenness of personal tragedy. You listen far more than say anything, Lanier said, who, as an airport chaplain, offers pastoral care in an array of mostly unforeseen circumstances. Being present is the key ministry gift we give to those we minister. He declined to discuss particulars about his conversations, but said he was working with a team of people of other religions who he could contact when he received a request for support from people who did not share his faith. "I was part of a team to holistically care for the hurting and confused," he said. "I was able to pray with those who requested prayer. It was an honor to serve with their permission by holding their hands and praying to our God, who was present, but at that time silent." Training for the what-ifs of air travel is a constant part of an airport chaplain's professional life. Sometimes they use a tabletop exercise where trainees talk through scenarios, said the Reverend Michael Zaniolo, the senior chaplain at Chicago O'Hare International Airport and the president of the National Conference of Catholic Airport Chaplains. Other times, airports hold full drills in which fire officials set an airplane-shaped simulator on fire and volunteers portray passengers who receive aid from the first responders, including chaplains. Every time they have this, they ask us to bring our chaplaincy team in order that we can train some of our chaplains, said Zaniolo. It allows them to pinpoint how they might help if a disaster occurs. What do you do at the rescue site? What do you do with the fire personnel or the morgue people? How does a chaplain fit into that? The Reverend Roderick Burton, president of the St. Louis Airport Interfaith Chaplaincy, said other traumatic situations can help chaplains also prepare for aviation disaster. Called to help the family of a student killed in a 2022 school shooting, he counseled them on having a spokesperson to help handle media requests, as well as unwelcome social media posts. More recently, he's assisted flood victims in his area when police chaplains sought additional aid. You can actually go and be present in other places that can also prepare you, he said. In the same way, Burton said he can count on other local first responder chaplains. God forbid if this were to happen in St. Louis. There's not enough of airport chaplains, said Burton, who hosted the International Association of Civil Aviation Chaplains when it met in his city in 2023. So we would call on the other hospital chaplains and police chaplains in the area to man that center 24 hours. All three chaplains spoke of the need to work in teams, helping fellow responders and fellow chaplains in times of greatest need, usually in a center that has been set up to assist those who have become disaster victims, their families, and friends. Burton said other airport workers may also need a listening ear, whether of the airport chaplain or clergy of another faith to whom the chaplain can refer them. There's the baggage crew that was waiting for the plane to land, he said. Other employees at the airport will be affected. Some may reach out for help, he said, long after the ambulances and fire trucks have left and an airport has returned to a sense of normalcy. Lanier, who also directs the chapel at Dulles International Airport, said he is working with the part-time chaplain at Dulles to support family and friends of the crash victims. But we are just now turning our attention to the direct care of first responders and the many airport workers that have been tirelessly supporting this crisis, he said. We've been working alongside them, but will now be more available to them as they begin to process all that has occurred. Airport chaplains are also prepared for passengers who die from natural causes while traveling and other more ordinary situations. I've been called in to help the airport with prior emergency situations, such as when people have passed away at the airport, said Lanier, who pastored two non-denominational congregations before becoming Ronald Reagan National's chaplain. But it does not compare to a mass casualty event of this nature and size. Zaniolo, who didn't hear of the mid-air collision until he woke up Thursday, said he will check in Friday with staffers at his airport who may be affected by the crash over the Potomac River. Like any family, when there's a tragic accident or sudden death, it's a traumatic thing, and people need to talk and process, some more than others, said Zaniolo, who was in his 25th year at O'Hare. They might know some of the people that were on board, or they might know some of the people in the crew. The chaplains know to train, too, to take care of themselves, so they can better take care of others. You have to learn about managing your own emotions in these crises, Burton said. Because if you're not well or you're overwhelmed, you can't help people that are overwhelmed. Zaniolo said chaplains at Chicago's airports have both a chaplaincy team, reflective vest, and a go kit that has holy oil, prayer books, and rosary beads to share with Catholics should a crisis arise. But the small knapsack also includes snacks and some water for the chaplain. That's the number one thing that they tell everybody who responds to something. Make sure you're hydrated. Make sure that you're not running on empty, because then you become a victim. Lanier said he has already been putting advice of that sort into practice. I listened to the emergency coordinator at 6 a.m. to go home, he said on Thursday. I was able to take a nap and a shower, then arrive back at 11. I was more refreshed and able to attend to the needs of others, plus encourage others to do the same. I have been in constant prayer throughout, so I believe God has strengthened me during this time. Now an article that was published by the New York Times News Service and reprinted in the News and Observer on February the 2nd, written by Alexandra Alter and entitled Dalai Lama Shares Thoughts on China, Future in New Book. During his decades living in exile, the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibet, has published dozens of books, including two autobiographies and works on ethics, Buddhist philosophy and practice, and the overlap between religion and science. But he has rarely delved extensively into raw politics. Now, in Voice for the Voiceless, Over Seven Decades of Struggle with China for My Land and My People, which comes out in March, he offers his first detailed account of his fraught negotiations with a succession of China's leaders, from meeting with Mao Zedong when he was just 19 to his more recent attempts to communicate with President Xi Jinping and other Chinese officials. It also delves into the Dalai Lama's efforts to preserve Tibet's unique culture, religion, and language, and to ensure protections for Tibetans living under Chinese rule. The book arrives at a particularly tenuous moment for the Tibetan people, with an ascendant China flexing its military and economic muscle around the world, and with Tibet's aging leader trying to ensure that Tibetans' struggle for autonomy isn't forgotten amid other global crises. As he nears 90, the Dalai Lama writes, he aims to leave a record of his work and guidance for those who take up the Tibetan cause after his death. Despite all the suffering and destruction, we still hold fast to the hope for a peaceful resolution of our struggle for freedom and dignity, the Dalai Lama said in a statement. Drawing on the lessons learned from my decades of engagement with Beijing, the book also aims to offer some thoughts on what might be the way forward. He continued, my hope is that the book will stimulate fresh thoughts and conversations today and provide a framework for the future of Tibet even after I am gone. Born into a farming family in 1935 in what was then northeastern Tibet, the Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, was recognized at age 2 as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama and began monastic training and Buddhist philosophical studies. When Chinese troops entered Tibet in 1950, he suddenly, at age 16, had to become Tibet's political leader and guide the country through the crisis. Tibet's right to independence has been in dispute ever since. In 1959, during the Tibetan uprising, the Dalai Lama fled the country for India, and he has never returned. I had hoped that I would be able to go back at least once before I die, he writes. This is looking increasingly unlikely. In Voice for the Voiceless, the Dalai Lama describes the personal toll that came with bearing responsibility for leading Tibet from a young age. He recalls meeting with Mao, the Chinese Communist Party's supreme leader, who revealed his disdain for Tibet's deeply spiritual culture. He describes how, after years of fruitless negotiations with Chinese leaders, he came to the decision that fighting for Tibetan independence was a lost cause. Instead, he began advocating for Tibetans to have cultural autonomy within China rather than full independence. He acknowledges that his moderate stance infuriated some Tibetans who felt he had abandoned their hope for restoring independence, and concedes that his approach has largely failed to get results. He also expresses his conflicting feelings about Tibetans who have self-immolated as a form of protest, noting that he sees their actions as a result of profound helplessness, even as he disagrees with their methods and insists on nonviolent protest as the only morally defensible form of resistance. In 2011, the Dalai Lama stepped down as the political leader of Tibet, paving the way for the Tibetan government in exile to elect its political leaders. He notes that his formal dialogue with the Chinese government over the status of Tibet stalled in 2010, but he continued to have informal and sometimes confidential contact with Chinese leaders until 2019. In the years since, he has watched with alarm as China has continued its efforts to force Tibetans to assimilate, using tactics that include placing Tibetan children in boarding schools where they learn in Mandarin and are taught that the Chinese liberated Tibetans from serfdom. He also delivers blunt criticism of China's treatment of its own citizens. Judging by Xi's last decade in office, when it comes to individual freedom and everyday life, China seems to be reverting to the oppressive policies of Mao's time, but now enforced through state-of-the-art digital technologies of surveillance and control, he writes. The Dalai Lama also addresses the fraught issue of his own succession. Tibetan Buddhists believe that the Dalai Lama is the 14th reincarnation of previous Dalai Lamas, and that he is an enlightened being who returns in successive lives to continue his work as a spiritual leader. But the Dalai Lama has warned that China might try to choose the 15th Dalai Lama after his death, as it has done with the Panchen Lama, another high-level Tibetan spiritual leader. To avoid Chinese interference, the Dalai Lama has said he will reincarnate in the free world, outside Tibet or China. And when he turns 90 this year, he writes, he will consult Tibetan religious leaders and citizens about whether they want to end the institution of the Dalai Lama altogether. Voice for the Voiceless will be published by William Morrow in the United States and Harper Nonfiction in Britain on March 11. And later it will be released in Australia, Canada, Germany, Italy, France, Holland, and Brazil. It is also being published in Tibetan and translated into Chinese in hopes that it might influence some Chinese readers, said Thubten Shinpa, the Dalai Lama's longtime translator, though the book will likely be banned in China. He wanted a testimony and an account of the evolution of his thinking, Zhenpa said. This book is an attempt to present in a single volume all of his efforts in not only reaching out to the Chinese for a negotiated settlement, but but also rebuilding Tibetan civilization in exile. Our last article was published in the New Yorker magazine on January 20 and written by Alec McGillis. We're hearing an excerpt of it. It's from the section, A Reporter at Large. On a Mission from God, Inside the Movement to Redirect Billions of Taxpayer Dollars to Private Religious Schools. On a Thursday morning last May, about 100 people gathered in the atrium of the Ohio Capitol building to join in Christian worship. The prayer at the State House was organized by an advocacy group called the Center for Christian Virtue, whose growing influence was symbolized by its new headquarters directly across the Capitol. It was also manifest in the officials who came to take part in the event, three state legislators, and the ambitious Lieutenant Governor John Husted. After some prayer and singing, the center's Christian engagement ambassador introduced Husted, asking him to share with us about faith and intersecting faith with government. Husted, a youthful 57-year-old, spoke intently about the prayer meetings that he leads in the governor's office each month. We bring appointed officials and elected officials together to talk about our faith and our work and our service and how it can strengthen us and make us better, he said. The power of prayer, Husted suggested, could even supply political victories. When we do that, great things happen, like advancing school choice so that every child in Ohio has a chance to go to the school of their choice. The audience started applauding before he finished the sentence. The center had played a key role in bringing about one of the most dramatic expansions of private school vouchers in the country, making it possible for all Ohio families, even the richest amongst them, to receive public money to pay for their children's tuition. In the mid-1990s, Ohio became the second state to offer vouchers, but in those days they were available only in Cleveland and were billed as a way for disadvantaged children to escape struggling schools. Now the benefits extend to more than 150,000 students across the state, costing taxpayers nearly $1 billion, the vast majority of which goes to the Catholic and evangelical institutions that dominate the private school landscape there. What happened in Ohio was a stark illustration of a development that has often gone unnoticed, perhaps because it is largely taking place away from blue state media hubs. In the past few years, school vouchers have become universal in a dozen states, including Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina. Proponents are pushing to add Texas, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and others. And with Donald Trump returning to the White House, they will likely have federal support. The risks of universal vouchers are quickly coming to light. An initiative that was promoted for years as a civil rights cause, helping poor kids in troubled schools, is threatening to become a nationwide money grab. Many private schools are raising tuition rates to take advantage of the new funding, and new schools are being founded to capitalize on it. With private schools urging all their student families to apply, the money is flowing mostly to parents who are already able to afford tuition and to kids who are already enrolled in private schools. When vouchers do draw students away from public districts, they threaten to exacerbate declining enrollment, forcing unpopulated schools to close. More immediately, the cost of the programs is soaring, putting pressure on public school finances, even as private schools prosper. In Arizona, voucher expenditures are hundreds of millions of dollars more than predicted, leaving an enormous shortfall in the state budget. States that provide funds to families for homeschooling or education-related expenses are contending with reports that the money is being used to cover such unusual purchases as kayaks, video game consoles, and horseback riding lessons. The voucher movement has been aided by a handful of billionaire advocates. It was also enabled during the pandemic by the backlash to extended school closures. Private schools often reported considerably faster than public schools. Yet much of the public, even in conservative states, remains ambivalent about vouchers. Voters in Nebraska and Kentucky just rejected them in ballot referendums. How then has the movement managed to triumph? The campaign in Ohio provides an object lesson, a model that voucher advocates have deployed elsewhere. Its details are recorded in a trove of private correspondence, much of it previously unpublished, that the movement's leaders in Ohio sent to one another. The letters reveal a strategy to start with targeted programs that place needy kids in parochial schools, then fight to expand the benefits to far-reacher families. A decades-long effort and network of politicians, church officials, and activists, all united by a conviction that the separation of church and state is illegitimate. As one of the movement's progenitors put it, government does a lousy job of substituting for religion. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.